The 60s brought tremendous social and cultural changes to this country. One of the men at the forefront of this movement is the former doctor of psychology who left convention behind in search of enlightenment.
Our guest today, Ram Dass, will describe the inner struggles that led him on a path to spiritual awareness and changed his life and the lives of many others.
Ram Dass, also known as Richard Alpert, received his Ph.D. from Stanford University. He has served on the psychology faculties of the University of California, Stanford University, and Harvard. In 1967, he traveled to India, where he met his guru, or spiritual guide, and teacher. While with his guru, he studied meditation and yoga and received the name Ram Dass, which means servant of God.
In 1973, Ram Dass started the Hanuman Foundation, which sponsors projects designed to enhance the spiritual quality of life. Ram Dass has authored several books, including Be Here Now, The Only Dance There Is, Grist for the Mill, Journey of Awakening, and The Miracle of Love. Welcome.
Welcome.
Thank you.
I thought you were asleep there for a minute in meditation. Stanford University, Harvard University, psychology, being on the faculty there. What took you away, as we said in the tease, from all that convention in search of enlightenment?
Probably what took me away was Tim Leary turning me on with mushrooms.
He
was a colleague of mine at Harvard.
And
he went to Mexico and took the Tiananocville, the flesh of the gods, used by the curanderos in Mexico. And he came back and he said, I learned more in 6 hours than I ever learned in psychology about my mind. And 6 months later, he guided me through a journey in which I saw a whole part of myself that psychology had nothing to do with at all. Not at all.
Do you think that in the 60s, you mentioned Timothy Leary helping you through mushrooms to understand your consciousness. We've often questioned what that drug-related culture did and how it seemed to change us socially. It seemed to change our religious aspects, our technology. A lot of things seemed to blossom out of that. Do you think that that was a necessary step for mankind, that we experienced that, the drug revolution?
Well, I think that the what happened in the 60s was pretty overdetermined. I think it was determined by the bomb, the threat of the bomb. I think it was determined by television, by travel. What was a shift in the way we see reality. Going from, it was like playing with time and space. So we went from seeing absolute reality as this to seeing this as relatively real. We did to our social perception what Einstein did to Newtonian physics, is really what happened in that 60s period. And I think the psychedelics played a part, which was then carried through the rock movement into a whole generation of consciousness. It was very overdetermined, though. Now it seems to me that those values are in the culture, and so that the drugs as a vehicle to do that, it's anachronistic now in some way to me.
It's moved away from that, and now it's the natural high.
Well, I think now you can grow up in this culture and live in a perceptual field of relative reality. I pick up kids, I meet somebody at 13, when I'm hitchhiking, and he can go right to my consciousness wherever it is, and he never took marijuana or acid or anything like that. He's from a small town in Idaho or something, you know.
But isn't it true that some of the gurus and spiritual teachers that you met and have met and that you ultimately found didn't either, and they were able to reach those same areas too?
Yeah, I think probably one of the profound experiences I had was when my guru asked me for my yogi medicine, which was LSD, and he took 1,200 micrograms, which is 4 huge human doses, and nothing happened at all.
Really?
And what he showed me was that what I take to go from point A to B, he already is A and B, and the whole thing was like drinking water for him.
And that the mind is very much in control of what it experiences.
Yeah, well, the mind is what it experiences.
Yeah.
I want to repeat something that went over very lightly.
Yes.
Even though you went through the drug experience in the 60s, and many scientists that we interviewed on the show,
yeah,
have related back that they did it on a scientific experimental basis. But what you're saying now, and I want to make clear, is that you don't feel that that is necessary or the course that one should take to receive enlightenment or consciousness, awareness that you had received under those circumstances. See, I see Timothy Leary, and this is my own personal opinion, that a man who saw tremendous vision,
yeah,
and then was stuck in reality and somehow couldn't build a bridge between the visionary thing that he was seeing and the reality he had to deal with. And there was a tremendous problem there. And when one steps into higher consciousness, and begins this perception that you're speaking about, it becomes difficult to deal with your reality.
To keep grounded. It's interesting. When I look at my audiences, half of them have gone out. They don't have a ground. Mm-hmm. You want to say, come on down. And the other half are just beginning to realize they could go out, and you want to say, go, go, go. Mm-hmm. So half you bring it back, and half you're sending out, which is an interesting one. Mm-hmm. But in the... Are you suggesting that the culture now doesn't need drugs? Is that what you're saying? Mm-hmm. Or that there are other ways of doing it?
Yeah, I think that what we have learned through that revolution and the things that have come out since the 60s, David Tard on astral projection that we know was accepted in a science journal. And
can I tell you one funny story? Take one minute. In the 60s, when I used to speak, late 60s, everybody looked the same. They all wore white, and they smiled a lot, and they had flowers, and it was a club, and I was sort of an uncle to the club. One night I'm lecturing, and down the front row is a woman with strawberries and cherries on her hat. She's about 70. She's got a black patent leather bag, a print dress, and responsible-looking Oxfords. Okay, now I'm at a club meeting of those who know better living through chemistry, right? And somebody brought her, I assume. And I say a far-out thing, and she's going like this. So I look at her, and I think, how does she know? So I say something a little more outrageous, and she's going like this. So I think maybe she's got a nervous problem with her neck, you know, so I'm watching very carefully. And she's right there. And at the end, I look at her, and she comes up, and she says, thank you, that was right. That's just the way I understand it to be. And I said, how do you know? What do you do that lets you know? She leaned up very conspiratorially, and she said, I crochet.
So,
and that immediately shows you, you know, that's the answer to that one for me.
So it is focusing on something that allows your mind to be free.
It's a whole variety of ways. People awaken by a leaf dropping. When they're ready to awaken, it may be through their heart, it may be through energy, it may be through the mind. Different strokes for different folks.
I have found when I tend my garden, my plants, I leave. That's when I'm
gone. For some it's running, for some it's crocheting, for some it's sex, for some it's scuba diving, for some it's hang gliding, cooking a bouillabaisse.
Are you saying it's not something you should be seeking after so much as just letting it happen naturally?
Seeking often gets in the way, and when you're really ready to go, you'll go.
Uh-huh.
You know, Ramana Maharshi said, I didn't eat, they said I was fasting. Mm. I like that image.
Mm. Yeah. Now, if you were to talk to our audience, and there's this great search for enlightenment and this great awareness, and there's so many classes on taking up psychometry and taking up this and psychic classes, what advice would you give? Would you take people into meditation?
I tell people to trust their own hearts, their own intuitive hearts, and listen. Just learn how to listen to their beings a little more and take whatever they need from wherever they can get it.
That means
maybe they see that they want to quiet their mind down and they'll be drawn to meditation. Maybe they feel their heart isn't open and they'll be drawn to bhakti or devotional yoga, or going to church or prayer or singing. Maybe they'll feel the energies in their body. They want to work through energies and they'll get into Tai Chi or Aikido or running or Hatha yoga or something like that. And they know, and they should trust it, and they should take a teaching as long as it's useful and then walk away from it.
When you say to follow what's in your heart, does that mean you have to get out of your mind?
Well, sooner or later, to hear the intuitive heart-mind, you will go beyond the intellect. Because the intellect is part of your psychosocial reality. Mm-hmm. And that's, you transcend the rational analytic mind, But you don't push it away. If you try to push it away, you feed it. So you just develop this, you go for this part of you that is intuitively knows, which is always there.
Mm-hmm. I call that bringing in my observer to watch over me.
Yeah. Well, that was Uspensky talked about the witness. Mm-hmm. But that is a middle step where you actually have an observer, because the role of an observer is still another psychological role.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, it's like before Satori, you chop wood and carry water, and after Satori, you're just doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You're not even noticing you're doing it. The noticing is a process. You babysit your own personality and consciousness until that spaciousness is just present.
You seem to carry in your reputation the idea of universal love and universal freedom. When a lot of people receive enlightenment that we deal with, it seems to become very discriminatory. Then they start putting other things down because now they're enlightened. And I don't feel that with you. Your presence here in this studio seems to show a general acceptance everywhere. And I'm confused whether enlightenment is supposed to separate you from what's going on, or does enlightenment expand your consciousness and accept what's going on?
Well, it feels to me like compassion is developing a balance between this, not the intellect, but the, like the third eye, the kind of higher wisdom, and the human heart. Because if you're in your human heart, you're busy protecting your separateness and judging other people. Your judging mind works in your human part. And then this other part just looks at what is, just sees law, you know. And when I put those two together, I just look at the world and see it. It's all God made manifest. Why do I have to judge it? I don't have to have opinions about everything.
And so, it really doesn't matter, probably, either.
It doesn't matter, no.
Yeah.
No, but that's scary to say, because it's supposed to matter.
But it doesn't matter.
The third Chinese patriarch, first line, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences.
I read a card once that said, if you want enlightenment, just quit cherishing your own opinion.
That's the same one. That's from there. Yeah. That's from the third Chinese patriarch.
Yes. Okay. We're going to be back. We are talking with Ram Dass, also known as Richard Alpert. And I think that you'll find the second half totally enlightened because we just began to scratch the surface. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
We're back in conversation with Ram Dass. We've been talking a lot about feelings and a lot about travel through time for enlightenment. I think you would agree that your journey, as any journey, is never complete. And the most recent work that you put together is The Miracle of Love, which is 1,000 collected stories of your guru.
My guru, yeah.
This is
a total rascal. I love rascals in the spiritual business.
Yeah. I think spiritual people should be happy and with a sense of humor. So many of them are so sad and so down.
Yeah.
And if you're interested in and in looking further into the philosophy of Ram Dass, this is his latest book, The Miracle of Love, and I'm sure the latest always concerns and holds the best of all that went before it. So it's The Miracle of Love, Ram Dass.
When you go back to Be Here Now, which was the first book that you put on paper after your experience with your guru, do you find that everything you said then, which is now 20 years practically ago, you believe today?
I still don't understand half of it. I mean, I don't figure it's my book anyway. You know, it's just a book, and I read it just like everybody else does. I mean,
you turn it around when you
well, what happened was the section that was really far out in that book happened when I'd be talking to audiences. It was tapes of when I'd be talking to audiences, and the chemistry of the situation would take me outside of myself. Like Edgar Casey could give a reading, but he didn't know what everything he knew. It was the same situation. And then this stuff goes into a book, and I read it like everybody else does.
So it's brand new material to you.
Always,
You know, that's interesting because most people we interview try to be their book. And several of them I had to suggest that they read their book and forget that they wrote it.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the valuable things is for people, when they feel that energy, to write down what they're feeling so later they can go back and read it with their mind, because I think that we can channel other parts of ourselves.
Yeah, we can. We can learn from ourselves, absolutely.
But we have to create a road for that channeling to come in.
Yeah.
When, in now, I noticed the key word to a lot of people is meditation. I noticed when you came into our studio that you placed yourself in some form of meditation. Is that a valuable key today? I mean, as far as you are concerned.
Well, it just feels like when I drive off the freeway and park and come in and meet two people and sit down, there are all these little subtle things that grab at your mind, thoughts, models, expectations. And if you can quiet down for just a moment and just center and just let all that go, then look at it all fresh, new moment, start again. And that's what I do. I just keep come into the moment, come into the present
moment. So as we say to someone, take a breath, just take a deep breath. And that's exactly what you're doing.
Exactly.
I'm amazed that you bring out the same philosophy that we heard, those expectations, those judgments, and everything that get in the way from letting us freely flow from a higher point of consciousness to freely flow. If you were to teach today, after all you've been through, I think as Stacy said, going back 20 years, you've indicated that you haven't understood yet a lot of the things that, you have done. What, to me or to you, is the most important thing that you could teach or say now to an audience that may not be familiar with the field of enlightenment or parapsychology or any of this?
Well, it's like saying to somebody, you are much more than you think you are. And that there are, as William James says, there are totally other planes of consciousness that you might spend your entire life without knowing of their existence. But they're all there. And the minute you quiet down a little bit and pull your awareness back just a little bit from your thinking mind, from your thoughts and your sensations, it all starts to open up for you. Mm-hmm. And it's a very simple thing. If you like being under the stars or sitting with a candle flame or something like that, just sit down and be quiet for a while and watch your own mind like leaves going down a river. Mm-hmm. And it all happens naturally. It doesn't have to be a big deal.
Would you say the first mistake that we all make is assuming we are not enlightened and that we must search for
it? I think the first mistake we make is cogito, ergo sum. We identify with our thinking mind. Mm-hmm. And it's really sum et cogito. You know, I am and I think.
We are so much
more than our thinking mind. And a thinking mind is an exquisite instrument, but it's like a beautiful servant, but a lousy master. You know?
Mm-hmm. In working with the people over the years, over the last 25 years, you've seen changes in your audience.
Yeah.
You spoke when we started of the group in white.
Yeah.
You know, with the flowers.
It's so heterogeneous now.
Who
it blows
do you have
my mind.
Now?
It's what I call a Martian takeover.
Yeah.
It's as if the shift in consciousness is in the culture. It's coming into the establishment of the culture now, so that people are doctors, lawyers, politicians, housewives, all roles, and yet we talk straight. Are you here? I'm here. It's as if they're beginning to recognize another part of their being, so that they are becoming able to fulfill their role without being caught in it. And it's amazing. I'd say 70% of my audience has never taken drugs, never been to India, never, you know, they just... and it doesn't matter. We're right here with each other. That's pretty impressive.
There are many people who might take a look at you and the youth of today and might say, gee, I guess he sold out. He's wearing a tie and he's got a jacket on. And here he sits. I guess he sold out.
But you see, at some point, you see that you can blend right into the woodwork because you don't have to be special because you are unique. No, and you don't have to keep courting your specialness. The symbols aren't necessary anymore because you have become what those were about more in your being. And then you don't want to have symbols that offend, that make other people say cult or whatever they need to say. Why should I alienate so many people? Why can't I be with them in the spirit too? I mean, I'm giving Dharma talks in the Episcopal Church, and I'm giving Dharma talks...
For heaven's sake, right?
Last week I was hired by a group of... financiers in San Francisco for a day-long seminar on the inner game of business. And I'm introduced as Dr. Alpert, and I come with my whole scene, and it's fine, why not? I say the same thing, I'm still talking about God, it's just I'm picking metaphors. And this is all metaphor.
You'll be doing Monday Night Football soon.
I don't mind, why not, you know, why not?
What I'm interested in is that, saying that you were a man that was at the forefront of this in the 60s, and you became so popular, and you were a great leader in the field of consciousness and still are. You are called a visionary.
Yeah.
What vision do you see for mankind? I mean, you've been watching this revolution from the 60s, now we're into the 80s, we're progressing, what
Look,
we're talking
you
about.
You can do the Armageddon scenario, you can do the Aquarian Age scenario, you can do Walter Cronkite saying that's the way it is today, you can do whatever scenario you want. I have no idea, I don't have any powers. I just know that every moment I've got to quiet my mind, open my heart, and do what I can to relieve suffering. That's my game. And I'm going to do that whether it's going to end in 5 minutes or 10,000 years. Because I don't really, the future isn't that critical to me. If this is enough, I'll know when I get to there, this will be enough.
I think that, I understand what you're saying, because I've seen a lot of people destroy themselves by the vision.
Exactly.
Because it's so far removed from where they are.
They get caught in their old thoughts.
Yeah. Yeah, it becomes
that's what
a mountain to climb.
Are, you know? Sure.
So your basic philosophy is really be here now.
I'm learning it.
And
I'm learning it.
You know, I like it when you say you're still learning it. So it's really be here now and learn to relax here and now. And doing that,
it
the future
but
kind
see,
of
see, a lot of people think of that as meaning irresponsible or not planning for the future. You can do all that. You can be very responsible and still be right here.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing all this quite impeccably.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we're not caught in it. Mm-hmm. If you're busy with all these roles, we lose.
Mm-hmm.
Yet we're right here, but we're here on a number of levels simultaneously.
Do you have a number of goals that you're working towards on several levels?
No. I can't think of any, other than what this is.
Mm-hmm.
And to be more here, and to be more with my heart more fully open, my mind quiet so I can really hear the Dharma, or hear the way of things, or the Tao. You know? And do what I can as a human being, because my heart hurts about the amount of suffering in the world. Do what I can to help the nuclear freeze, to help the blind, to help the starving, to help the people that are undergoing violence, to do all that. at the same moment with this higher wisdom seeing the perfection of it all, including the suffering. And that's what's so far out being a human, because it pushes you till you've got to grasp both of those, that it's perfect and it stinks, that you're divine and you're human. You know, up here it's very cold. You look out, somebody falls down, you say, karma. But down here, you know, and then if you just stay down here, you burn out, because there's so much suffering. Where do you even begin?
In listening to you, I've developed a thought inside of myself I'd like to try on you.
Sure.
A spiritual man or an enlightened man doesn't have to make a decision. He knows. And I always felt that any time I was forced to make a decision regarding the future, it was simply because I didn't understand where I was in the present.
Exactly right.
And that if I am alive to the present and all the things in it, the future makes
all
itself obvious a step at a time.
All the decisions follow. It's like reading your own book.
Yeah.
It's all obvious. It's just when you don't, when you have to make a choice, you're not standing in the right place.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree with that, because in all the years of interviewing, so many of our guests give so many future goals to people, so many future visions, that as I said just earlier, it becomes a very steep mountain these people must climb.
And it's a way to put themselves down. It's a way to keep the mea culpa going for a few more years, you know.
For my fault.
We always say, oh God, please, we never say yes, you know. I mean, we think that's too much chutzpah, you know, but actually, that's who we are.
I was praying once real hard for something to happen. I kept praying, and I heard the voice, which I'll call my observer or whatever, inside my head, just say, well, if you shut up for a minute, I'd answer you. So from that day on, I never prayed for anything in particular.
What could you pray for?
You
it's all doing fine. What are you going to pray for? I think it's going great.
I believe that, I'll try this, and you place yourself in a state of neutrality when you pray, so that you can be open to any direction.
Whatever.
That the
you just pray to hear. Here. You just pray to hear how it is.
Pray to hear. Now that's a whole new word for that.
Yeah.
I really thank you for this half hour you spent with us.
Thank you. It's really nice being with both of you. Really.
You've taken a lot of the struggle out of growth, and you made it a pleasant thing that we can experience right here and right now and not have to wait for the future. We hope that this present, this half hour we shared with you, will make you happy where you are and you'll have a better future. Thank you for being with us. See you again real soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dan.
I could just
pleasure.
Sit and know. But why don't you just stay here and we'll just talk for another hour.